Well, thank you very much. Thanks to our three initial panelists for, I think, explicit examples of how to use a short amount of time to very good effect. Plainly, this is something of an iterative conversation. We're each addressing issues that overlap into each other. But the focus of this first panel has plainly been primarily on issues of risk, of measurement, uncertainty, regulation in this area. We move on into who knows what in the second round. We always have more business, perhaps more values, questions coming up. I'd like to begin by asking each of the first three panelists for a quick response on this, and then we'll open this up for wider discussion. Whether they consider, I mean, professionally, of course, they're all very much involved with this, and some, if you like, on the other side of the debate, whether they consider that the responsible authorities, both obviously in this case here in the UK and in Europe, as well as also on the global scale, have responded adequately to the risk, uncertainty questions with their regulatory implications when faced by, of course, what is one level not a technology, but a scale in which basically, and to which basically so many technologies are racing down, such that the implications don't really compare with those of any other specific technology development from the past. This is something of a new ball game we're playing. But whether you consider there has been an encouragingly good, adequate kind of response, or whether you think there really has been a serious gap between the nature of the questions and the nature of the response. Because I think I'd be very interested to take some soundings and see how the three of you respond on that spectrum.
I could start. I think that one area I'd like to see more debate is about the amount of risk taken in society generally and how that should be spread amongst the parties. Because I mentioned earlier about the compensation culture, and I find that, I mean, obviously I would say this because we end up paying claims and it can cost a lot of money for us, but it's quite an unhealthy blame culture that we have. Mm-hmm. And yet, unless there's sort of we face up to that and sort of argue where should the liability fall, are there certain things that we wish to, try with these small steps you described? And if it turns out badly, then, that was done. We did it with our eyes open. Should you expect traditional recourse here through the courts? Some of the purposes in nanotechnology, such as solar panels, etc., are so worthwhile in trying because of the benefits to society that the occasional bad outcome might be warranted. But what is difficult is for an industry like the insurance industry, when those bad outcomes can spread very widely, to really give cover. Okay. So I think I'd like to see a debate about the risk in society generally, and think about the role of the different parties.
There's a note that sort of assumptions being made about risk tolerance. Well, it is very interesting. I mean, the classic example here, well, two classic examples. One is that the FDA, the US Food and Drug Administration, would not approve aspirin or penicillin. Now, there's pretty much an agreement on that, because of the way in which risk assumptions have changed. And secondly, of course, that if you want to save lives and save life years, you go after the cars and the roads. Yeah. And you reduce speed limits. So putting them up now here, and so on and so forth. I mean, the classic sort of bifurcation in the way in which we regard certain areas and other areas. And I think the technology questions are bringing us particular focus, and this is precisely your job. So that's very helpful. Let's move around.
Yeah, talking about cars. We're a test laboratory for new equipment for measuring nanoparticles in a sort of work environment. And frankly, we have far more nanoparticles coming from the traffic exhaust than the road outside of the air, generating and exposing our staff and our researchers in the lab. Yet, in the UK, DEFRA, I think, has done quite a good job in promoting the precautionary principle, has indicated a load of categories and some behaviours that responsible organisations, and that includes us in universities, need to follow. Those are advisory. It's not in regulation yet. The problem is it does take... I mentioned there's 100 million euros worth of research being spent on environment, health, safety, risk assessment, risk management. It does take a lot of different disciplines, and it does take a lot of time before consensus emerges, and we'll see some of that, I think, when Peter comes on later on. So the precautionary approach is working. Europe has its regulation, the registration, evaluation, and control of hazardous chemicals. And that is also taking a precautionary approach, but there is pressure from Europe to go faster to put regulation in place. Ultimately, the best way of quantitating risk is getting a lot of good science and a lot of engagement with our citizens, our population, and reaching some consensus. But it will take some time, I'm afraid.
I think in terms of thinking about where exposures are likely, that is in the workplace initially, there's a lot of effective regulation in place already, although there are concerns in places about how effective certain kinds of personal protection equipment and so forth are in the labs where R&D has been done. But nonetheless, if you think about where the exposures are likely to occur, the regulation is there. I think some of the issues surrounding chemicals and their use in products are much more it's more difficult to answer. The issues there are so much more complex. And REACH, for instance, there are well acknowledged issues there with how far REACH covers some nanomaterials and so forth. But I'd agree in order to bring regulation on the stream, the key issue is to advance knowledge in nanotoxicology.
Mm. Okay, well, since we're merging, we've got these two poles. We have we have the science, technology, we have the data, but then we also have public understanding, because public is well able to have very bifurcated approaches to its tolerance of risk, and I think that in my sense is increasing. That is going to be the problem. Because the public is very subjective about these things. There are some trends in our view of how you hold people accountable and so on, and those things seem to be moving the wrong way if you're looking to embrace novel developments. But let's take some questions and comments. Please introduce yourself briefly and say whom you'd like to respond to you, or just make a brief contribution. Over to you. Somewhat somnolent group we have here this afternoon. Yes, please.
As far as I'm aware, only one company has done this, and insurers have what we call a risk appetite, and it's quite possible that insurer just doesn't have any appetite for this sort of technology, so they have excluded it. That doesn't mean it's irresponsible, it's just them and their own shareholders sort of in a dialogue of what sort of risks they want to cover and what they don't want to cover. There are other insurers that have actually created policies for nano industries, so would it be irresponsible or responsible for the whole industry to react in that way is an interesting question. I think that where the risks to capital are very unclear, then if you think about it on the flip side, what would you want for your pension fund? Would you want them to put your pension at risk? Then I think it is responsible to think quite deeply about these issues. Preferably, though, engaging in a dialogue and before it gets all the way to the exclusion point, I think.
Yes?
Kathleen Richardson, Research Fellow at University College London. Thank you for your talks. It was very interesting because you come from three different perspectives. And I really like Professor Wilkins.
Yes.
I really liked your talk because you were very enthusiastic about the technology and unless you saw risk as part of the interest in the technology. And I wonder, in some respects, is risk actually the wrong way of thinking about nanotechnology? Wouldn't it be better to develop a kind of a culture of ethics? Because when you start weighing things up in terms of risk, what is risky and what is not, then you start developing the mindset of the economist, no offence, but
look where that goes.
It's a different kind of mindset, whereas if you start thinking in terms of ethics, and I think somebody made this point earlier about, you're thinking about social and cultural advantages and disadvantages. So I just wonder if, I know it's part of this modernity, where unintended consequences, that's where this language has come from, but I sometimes wonder whether it gets in the way of kind of the excitement and the possibilities and probably even a strategic way of dealing with these issues.
Well, would you rather be an ethicist than a sort of risk guy? I mean, it's an interesting question, because I mean, I suppose you could talk about sort of virtue ethics, in which basically people are making responsible ethical decisions, and you rely upon that rather than putting undue weight on the sort of risk assessment.
Yeah, well, I personally think that principles-based is always better than reams and reams of regulation and box-ticking, so that's definitely true. I do think that people that ultimately write the checks tend to think more in terms of risk than people that are thinking about the money to be made from the technology. That's not a symmetrical position. And I guess our shareholders would want us to be thinking in that way. I also, going back to my earlier point, think that this division of responsibility amongst the stakeholders is a worthwhile conversation. It may be that we can cover a part of the risk, but not all of it. And that might then feed back to making people think a bit more ethically and a bit more risk averse. I don't know.
I like the idea of having an ethical approach. As you saw in our planning for Framework 6, we tried to introduce risk management into the whole concept. I've just come back from Washington, where I think you're based, at a joint meeting. We had a collaborative research project with some American universities about responsible nanotechnology and the ethics of nanotechnology. In our university, we've been running ethics training for nanotechnology students for about the last 5 years. So we tried to practice what we preach and get those kind of issues debated and discussed by the students and the researchers at that kind of level. So we do believe in doing it and pushing it out. In terms of practicing what you preach, my first product was launched in 1982, nanoparticles. I didn't know I was working in nanotechnology at the time, but I thought these particles looked a bit odd. We better play safe. And so we any waste material we disinfected so there's no biological risk, and then we incinerated them because we didn't think it was a good idea to put these things down into the drain and into the environment. So we were just being precautionary at the time. You could go a long way by being precautionary if everybody knows what those rules are, and we regularly update those rules in light of new knowledge.
If I might add, you're quite right that going down the regulatory route and thinking about risk, to write a regulatory contract for a new technology, it'll only take you so far. And that ultimately, the technology and its products have to have some kind of broader social legitimacy. And that's why there's been so much effort, particularly in the UK, over the last 5 to 10 years, I think, in trying to establish public engagement as an important part of the development of nanotechnologies. And that when you look at that research that's been done on how best to go about that, you find that, in general, your average member of the public, whatever that means, but tends to not be too concerned about risks as these kind of free-floating objects, much more concerned about the social context in which the technology has been developed, what benefits it's going to have and for whom, and so forth, and to think about its overall value, its social value, on that basis.
Yes. I'm Lynn Green. I'm one of the trustees of the BioCenter. The teeth that the risk approach has is obvious. Is it possible to have any teeth or power of enforcement with an ethical approach?
Good question. Takes us to Plato's navigator problem. Mm-hmm. Who do you choose to drive things forward if you're going into uncharted territory? Do you elect people and run the risk of getting a politician who knows nothing about it? Or do you go after appoint people who are competent to help guide you in these things?
Am I right in assuming there's no real teeth at the moment to any ethical guidelines? Is that right?
I'm not aware of any. Are you aware of any? Anybody else aware of
any? Ethics. Yeah. If you steal nanomaterials, this is a crime. I don't think there are any specific nano-ethical rafts of legislation pending. Because part of what interests me about nanotechnology precisely, and this is part of, because it was referenced made earlier to Mike Roker and Bill Bainbridge, and their conferences and books on convergence back in the early 2000s in Washington. In fact, Mike Rokin was on a panel we had last week talking about some of these questions, is precisely that you're throwing everything into a mix at this point, because the implications of nanoscale are precisely indefinite. And you're not specifically talking about, I mean, when there was discussion about recombinant DNA back 25 years ago, it's very specific, do we, don't we, what are the rules going to be? Of course, it doesn't really work, so it was somewhat of an unnecessary anxiety. But here you're talking about something which essentially is pervasive of our capacity to manipulate nature, the human condition, and so on. So in a sense, it's a different kind of thing. I'm sure we will come back to this, but I think it is the case that, so far as I'm aware, no one has a proposal for a nano law. Many of these questions, of course, fall within current models. Other questions? At the very back. Thank you. One or two more hands here. We'll take your points before we wrap up. Yes, please. Two quick comments.
I think, maybe I can start. This question of when, the interest in the UK government in an upstream process, very early on in development, before applications have emerged concretely, was, I think, an interesting step forward. There has been, however, a lot of debate about that since, and some good points have been made about it, in my view, with regard to how far you sustain that. The problem with upstream engagement is that once it's been done, it's very difficult to make it feed back into regulation in a way that's effective, or maybe not even regulation, maybe just to help shape innovation as such, to help forge some kind of common understanding of what's actually needed from this technology. And whether you need some kind of iterative process of engagement which accompanies an innovation along its track, begins upstream, continues to allow people to reflect quite deeply on the kinds of values and priorities that technologies are beginning to address. So I think there's some important questions to be answered there, and I think the upstream engagement debate is a really important one to have in the UK, but I think it needs to come back into the limelight again.
I think we'll come back. Do you want to make a comment here without losing the major point of your presentation from the next round? Do you want to throw it here?
Is the question about stakeholder
Well, in general, I mean, we're wrapping up the first panel, so you can throw something in now if you like on these various range of... I mean, it's been a pretty connected discussion, interestingly, across these different...
There have been quite a few social experiments involving stakeholders at quite an early stage. Some of them... citizens' forums, for example, the Food Safety Authority in this country has been, over the last few months, holding a series of stakeholder citizens' forums, one of which I participated in, more or less bringing people in off the street, telling them something about nanotechnology, and then saying, what do you think of this from various points of view? Last week I was in a stakeholder dialogue in Europe for Nano Impact Net, one of the FP7 projects in which we had 200 people, most of them scientists, discussing general questions, but also people from consumer societies and so on. And the main discussion there was around nanomedicine, and it's quite surprising in a little poll that we had for about 150 people or so there that 20% of them thought that nanomedicine would not have any major impact on the development of medicine in the next 20 years, which was quite surprising when you consider that, I suppose, 60-70% of the audience were, in fact, scientists and technologists and people from medicine.
Well, perhaps they were what Paul Nurse was saying 5 years ago rather than what he's saying now.
And equally interesting, about 20% said that they thought that nanomedicine was too risky to develop under present circumstances. And then we had a debate around that. I think that was a surprising finding as well. So, you know, there are all sorts of arenas in which there is stakeholder dialogue going on. It's not been captured much by the press or the popular media at the moment. I'm not sure what the reason for that is.
Yeah. My chairman's privilege, a final comment before we wrap up this panel. I think it's been a very interesting half conversation. And this point hasn't quite been made in these terms. The way I try to lead these conversations across the Atlantic, where I do this much more frequently, is to try to focus the nature of the innovation discussion as one in which obviously the capital markets are driving what takes place. In some cases, public capital, typically private capital, and within which values questions are central ultimately to markets, as they're central to the prospective regulatory regimes 10 years down the line. And therefore that the innovation process needs to involve risk considerations of a general character, obviously environmental risk and so on and so forth, and health and sort of other direct questions, also needs to involve values. So ultimately it is the investors who finally will shape what comes out of the R&D and much of the R&D itself, who will be the ones who will be motivated to build in the values discussion into the innovation process at the very early stage. Particularly at a point at which, I mean, if you're a venture capitalist, you know, one guy I know, he says, well, every month we get 100 projects come into my office. They're all being screened. They're all very good. I fund 2 new ones. So 1 in 50 is the ones he's funding. He hasn't got any skin in the game at this point. And he is the one who needs to be the person listening to the values discussion, as well as the broader risk issues, way ahead of the public regulators and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that ultimately it's going to be largely private capital that will determine what comes out of these things. So I'll throw that in, perhaps something to pick up later on. We're exactly on time. There is a so-called comfort break, which I gather is now a British term. Matt, where is the comfort to be found?
If required, down the corridor, down the external light, down the corridor, and down on the left-hand side.
Well, please be back promptly in 10 minutes. I want to thank our first panel very much.